Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Tuesday, October the 7th. I'm John Dennis. Fresh fears of a global recession after a day of dramatic falls in share prices.
We've stopped actually saying Black Monday or Black Tuesday or Black Friday because every day is a black at the moment, it seems. It's one series of catastrophes after another.
In the UK today, the Bank of England's putting another £40 billion into the markets. Gordon Brown has chaired the first meeting of his new Economic War Council. But as yet, no big rescue plan.
How do you recapitalise the banks? That's the big question. They ain't saying, but clearly they're working on it.
And in other news today, Oxford and Cambridge universities take their ancient rivalries into the 21st century. They're making podcasts.
20,000 bicycles, off to labs and lecture rooms, tutorials and training. There's much to do, exams to pass, dreams to fulfil.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about that, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news headlines and a look at the papers.
In the USA and Asia, stock markets have fallen heavily following the markets in Europe. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell up to 800 points, a one-day record, but then recovered slightly before the close. The Japanese market slumped 5% at opening, but then also rose a little. It's been driven by the uncertainty on European markets because of fears of more bank failures. In one case, a whole country, Iceland, is in danger of going bankrupt, according to its prime minister. In Luxembourg, European finance minister meet today to try to find a coordinated solution to the crisis. A meeting of some leaders in Paris at the weekend failed to get joint action working as Germany went it alone in offering guarantees for bank deposits. The European Commission has suggested a guarantee for deposits across all the European countries. In the USA, the government is trying to calm fears by getting the bank bailout scheme, passed by Congress last week, underway. A top official to lead the process has been named. But at the same time, two state governments, California and Massachusetts, have warned that they may need federal loans to keep them going. We'll have a full report on the economy later in Guardian Daily. Britain's independent climate change committee is warning the country must give up all fossil fuels in 20 years in a report published today. It recommends that we must cut our greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. It's unlikely that aviation and transport will cut fast enough, so the rest of us must compensate, the committee chairman's told The Guardian. Back in the USA, the two presidential candidates are warming up for their live TV debate by dishing the dirt on each other. John McCain's linked Barack Obama with a former member of an urban guerrilla group, Bill Ayers. The Democrats have responded with a documentary on the internet describing McCain's involvement in a previous financial crisis, which also involved mortgages, back in 1989. All the papers have to cover the economic turmoil. Market slump, says The Guardian. Market mayhem, The Telegraph calls it. The Times says the world takes fright, and The Independent calls it the day that fear hit the markets. The Express simply orders the PM to save us from a slump. Brown must stop dithering. But The Sun also puts the story of goalkeeper Luke McCormick on its front page after he was sent to prison for killing two young brothers in a drink-drive accident. It says he could be out of jail in 3.5 years, which it says is pitiful. The Mail chooses the inquest of Manchester senior policeman Mike Todd, who died on Snowdon, having taken drugs and alcohol. There have been many reports about his active extramarital love life, but his wife sat through the inquest impassively and afterwards told the paper that she forgave her dead husband. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The contagion from Wall Street spread across the world yesterday. In London, more than £93 billion was wiped from the value of Britain's biggest companies as the FTSE 100 index suffered its biggest fall for 21 years. Central banks, including the Bank of England, are pumping fresh billions into the markets. Our economics editor, Larry Elliott, says it was a black day on the markets, even by recent standards.
We've stopped actually saying Black Monday or Black Tuesday or Black Friday because every day is a black at the moment, it seems. It's one series of catastrophes after another. And yesterday we had a massive fall in the FTSE in London. We had Dow down 400 points after a week in which it dropped 750 points the week before. We had stock markets closed in Brazil and Russia. We had, looks like, Iceland just about going bust because of the problems of its banking sector. We had a massive fall in the oil price as people worried about the global economy plunging into recession. We had real strains in the foreign exchange markets with currencies gyrating all over the place. And we've still got this real logjam in the money markets, which is stopping banks from lending to each other, just fear of other banks going bust. So, I mean, you've got paralysis in the credit markets, and that's starting to have real economic impacts on the ability of businesses to keep going and keep functioning. So it's a very, very serious day indeed. Yesterday really was, even in the hyperbole of recent weeks, it really was a Black Monday.
And looking at the political response, we saw Alistair Darling making a statement to the Commons after Gordon Brown's the first meeting of his economic war cabinet, as it's been called, met in the morning. Some commentators were expecting an announcement on recapitalisation of banks.
Yeah, I wasn't, but after my conversations with Treasury people last week, government ministers and officials last week, it left me really in no doubt that they weren't at this point thinking about some sort of big bank strategy to recapitalise the banks, although it is an option which is being considered. Darling said yesterday they are considering all options, but they want to actually go a bit further down the road before they get to them. I personally think that's a mistake, that it's a bit like the grand old Duke of York. They've marched people to the top of the hill and now they're marching them down again. And that was one reason why shares were in such trouble yesterday, because people were anticipating something from the Chancellor a bit more meaty than what they got. I mean, he kept saying that we will do whatever it takes, but he didn't actually explain what that might be. And I think people have got getting a bit fed up with hearing the government say it will do whatever it takes. It wants to see now some sign that the government intends to get ahead of the curve rather than be constantly dragged into action belatedly. And there are two things it could have done yesterday, which I thought it might have done. One would have been to offer a blanket guarantee to all depositors, which is obviously what's happening in other European countries. Another thing would have been to announce some form of government-backed recapitalisation of the banks, with the government taking some sort of equity stake in three or four of the big British banking institutions. I thought that would have been an appropriate response to the scale of the crisis.
And the crisis is making it harder and harder for governments to act in tandem. I mean, at the weekend we saw the leaders of France, Italy and Germany meet and to discuss some kind of global financial regulation that they might be able to work towards. But then the very next day, Germany acts unilaterally to guarantee savings.
Yeah, this is a real repeat of where we were in the 1930s, and one of the reasons that things went from bad to worse in the 30s was that you had sort of beggar my neighbour policies, and then it was devaluation that the first country to devalue got an advantage over all the other countries, and so you sort of had a sort of domino effect. Now we're seeing the same sort of thing in terms of offering guarantees to savers, but it's exactly the same sort of response. Faced with a crisis, you don't act in concert with all your partners, you act for the benefit of your own country, and that is an issue. It's a really, really important issue as well, because the IMF is meeting this week to discuss the global response to the crisis, and trying to get some sort of unified response to it is absolutely vital, because the more countries just plump for go-it-alone strategies, the worse this crisis is going to get.
Larry Elliott, our economics editor. Well, in the UK, Gordon Brown chaired his first twice-weekly meeting of his National Economic Council, what's been described as his war cabinet. The Prime Minister also spoke to European leaders and the International Monetary Fund. In the House of Commons, the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, told MPs there'd be fresh liquidity, courtesy of the Bank of England.
Mr. Speaker, I've always been clear that each country needs to do whatever is needed to deal with its own particular circumstances. However, I also believe that wherever it is possible to do so, countries should work together and act to maintain stability.
Well, as Larry Elliott said, the government's repeatedly been saying it'll do whatever it takes, but we're no closer to finding out what that might be. Our political commentator Michael White says Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling don't want to be rushed into announcing a big rescue plan.
Well, Treasury officials say there is no plan. We respond case by case. We're not saying much until we have to, until we've got all the details and all the colleagues sorted out and lined up, because there's been too much unilateral action in recent days. Remember what Dublin did, and then several other countries have followed suit, including Germany, which really shocked officials, I think. So all they're saying, we can't do things which destabilise still further the financial markets unless we're clear, and we're doing it gradually, and it's all in hand. I must say, sometimes Alistair Darling's air of calm is very irritating when he should be putting the boot into somebody, but I thought, oh well, you know, he's not going to do anything crazy, is he? It was not a particularly information-rich day, but at least Darling just sets it out and says, you know, it'll all be all right, we're working on it.
Is this partly because they've learned a lesson from the mistakes of the way that the rescue plan was put forward by the US Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson in the US?
You're absolutely right to highlight that. In fact, Darling himself, who's not a great one for criticising other people, even when they deserve it, said, well, the US plan was put forward and one that wasn't fully thought out. It caused a lot of turmoil and we want to avoid that. At least he more or less said that. That's what he meant. I'm sure he didn't use such inflammatory language. And, we get the impression that they say, well, we've responded to, you know, problems with individual banks. We're dealing with them. Each case is different, case by case. We've tried to put liquidity back into the markets. That means money which the banks can borrow to suit their short-term needs because they're also scared to lend to each other because they don't know whether one or other party is going to go bankrupt tomorrow because of all its debts, which are still being sorted out, back to that wretched subprime stuff last summer. So there are two issues there. There's liquidity and also solvency. And the third bit, the intriguing bit, is whether or not they're going to what they call recapitalise the banks. In other words, things have gone so badly that the banks, enormous amount of debts and lending and borrowing, they're undercapitalised. And anybody who's ever played Monopoly in their childhood will dimly remember these phrases. How do you recapitalise the banks? That's the big question. They ain't saying, but clearly they're working on it, and will be keen to make sure that what they do doesn't, you know, undermine the Germans or even the Irish.
Well, it's all hands on deck, was what Peter Mandelson said last week on his shock recall to the cabinet. Does Gordon Brown's new economic war council make any difference to the government's ability to steer us through this crisis?
Well, it's certainly meant to. I mean, Mr. Brown is really fired up about this. He says he thinks it's a good idea and other people will do it too. In other words, you pull together all the economic ministries and you make them meet twice a week. You make them make sure they're doing the same thing. As you and I know in journalism and everybody listening knows in their own office, it's surprising the extent to which people do their own thing without realising that other colleagues are doing something different. I'm sure that's partly what's behind it, but we don't know much about its achievements yet. I don't think the markets have been stabilised simply by the knowledge that it's there. One other thing to mention worth saying, George Osborne, who made a ferocious attack on Brown, if you remember, the Conservative conference in Birmingham last week, did make the effort to say we must rally round, although he put a few pokes in with a sharp stick as he did so. Vince Cable, the Lib Dem spokesman, very knowledgeable on economic matters, urged Alistair Darling to tell the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, they're the people who decide interest rates, he said, make sure they get back the message back here on planet Earth, we need lower interest rates. And typical Darling said, once you set up an independent body, it doesn't help its credibility or anything else to try and tell it what to do. Very Alistair Darling response, and absolutely right. Though we all hope and expect that the MPC will indeed lower interest rates, make life a little easier for everybody in the next few days.
Michael White, and the latest news from the markets today is at guardian.co.uk/business. And you can have your say on what you've been hearing in today's podcast about that or any other subject, guardian.co.uk/Guardian Daily. Also on the Guardian's website today, details of Sarah Palin's finances have been revealed ahead of the second TV debate tonight between the presidential candidates John McCain and Barack Obama. Follow it live tonight at guardian.co.uk/America. Who is still smoking? John Henley investigates at guardian.co.uk/G2. And Faye Dunaway is interviewed by Zan Brooks at guardian.co.uk/film. One in four of the world's mammals are at risk of extinction. That's according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. That's an alliance of governments and NGOs. Its latest red list of endangered species says that 188 species are critically endangered. Heather Soule is species officer at the World Wildlife Fund UK.
The red list is looking at classifying species according to their extinction risk, and it's developed by a voluntary network membership of species specialist groups, and so there are 7,000 experts that all contribute to classifying species according to these threatened categories.
And what does the study say this year?
Well, it's the most comprehensive assessment of the world's mammals so far. And what it's showing is that we are at a crisis point. Almost one in four species of mammals are at risk of disappearing forever.
Which species are particularly at risk?
Okay, well, it classifies things into different categories, and the worst is obviously extinct in the wild. And this year we've seen the Piers David's deer, which is found in China, has gone into the extinct in the wild category. But also there are some more commonly known species. The Iberian lynx, for example, has just been listed on the critically endangered. And that only has a population of 84 to 143 adults. So you can see that we've got a severe problem here in, you know, a very loved species in the European region.
Which areas of the world are most affected?
The main threats that are affecting species are habitat loss and degradation, overexploitation, pollutants getting into the environment, and climate change. And what we're seeing is that habitat loss and degradation is affecting 40% of the world's mammals, and those are most extreme in Central and Southern America, in Western, Eastern and Central Africa, in Madagascar, and in South and Eastern Asia.
And what should we do to protect these species?
Well, this list is so important for this because we want the decision makers who are deciding on policies, who are deciding on where our funds are going to be allocated, to actually act on this. And so we need to make sure that there are controls stopping habitat loss when it's looking at infrastructure development or logging. We need to make sure there's proper enforcement in terms of making sure that those trade controls are actually implemented. We need to stop the pollution, and most importantly, we need to make sure that we make a commitment and actually act on reducing our carbon emissions, because climate change is a global problem.
Heather Soule from the World Wildlife Fund. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, the virtues of loft-style living in the beautiful Yorkshire countryside.
We're in the barn now, and it's much bigger inside than it looks from the outside. It's kind of TARDIS-like, and it's interesting that the pod takes up less than half.
But first, Oxford and Cambridge universities are making podcasts, and not just for students. There'll be 450 hours of downloads available, of lectures, but also audio and video guides on how to apply for Britain's most prestigious universities. They've enlisted some of their illustrious alumni, economists such as Joseph Stiglitz and Sir Nicholas Stern, scientists including Ian Wilmot, creator of Dolly the Sheep, and the genome expert Craig Venter. Even the world's top mathematician Carol Vorderman is taking part. With the details is the editor of guardian.co.uk/education, Donald MacLeod.
It seems to be a mixture of come apply to Oxford or Cambridge, and also showing off the kind of intellectual firepower that they have, the kind of lectures, talks that the dons there produce.
Presumably some fascinating subjects.
There are. The most popular download from the Cambridge, on Cambridge iTunes, is Cambridge Codebreakers and British Intelligence. And the whole, there's another one about the Enigma project, which broke the code during the war.
Why are Oxford and Cambridge doing this simultaneously?
They say it's because they're cooperating. I think outsiders would say it's because it's another sort of boat race battle between the two ancient universities of England, and they're going head to head, both in promoting themselves and also reaching out to a wider public, the sort of curious, intellectually curious reader, viewer, who might be interested in what's going on there.
Well, as you say, I mean, the rivalry between Oxford and Cambridge has been going on for centuries. Is it possible to say who's winning?
I think the verdict's, the jury's still out on that one, John.
OK, and I mean, they have got some famous names to encourage people to apply to Oxford and Cambridge, including, for Oxford, Michael Palin.
20,000 bicycles, off to labs and lecture rooms, tutorials and training. There's much to do, exams to pass, dreams to fulfil. 25 prime ministers came from this place, 47 Nobel Prize winners, at least 20 archbishops of Canterbury, 12 saints, and one mayor of London. Oxford pulsates with energy and drive.
If you're looking for an undergraduate course at one of the world's great international universities, you should certainly consider Cambridge. It's a beautiful city, where the teaching is delivered often by leading academics in their fields, and where students live in the friendly communities of Cambridge's old and new colleges.
And they do paint the picture there, Donald, of very much the sort of Oxford that we might, you know, the dreaming spires that we might have seen in sort of costume dramas and so on.
Although he does mention exams and work to be done as well. So it's not all dreaming spires. I mean, he mentions the roll call of prime ministers from Oxford. Cambridge might perhaps stress its record of Nobel Prize winners.
What are Oxford and Cambridge hoping to achieve by making these downloads available?
Well, I think they're trying to attract the next generation of students who are, you know, happier or as happy downloading stuff to their iPod as reading a prospectus. They're trying to get rid of their stuffy image, but also to promote themselves internationally. I think this is they see themselves not just as purely English or British institutions, but competing with Harvard and Stanford in the States, where the Ivy League universities already download a lot of their talks and lectures.
Well, quite. I mean, what was taking Oxford and Cambridge so long?
Well, they're certainly not the first in Britain. Earlier this year, University College London and the Open University, they were the first British ones to join iTunes U. And 2 years ago, Glasgow philosophy lecturer Susan Stewart became a surprise hit on the iTunes education chart with her introduction to the German philosopher Immanuel Kant.
I smell a hit.
Well, it was pretty hardcore philosophy. But it seemed to appeal right round the world.
Donald MacLeod. Fields separated by dry stone walls are characteristic of the Yorkshire Dales, one of the most distinctive landscapes in Britain. And scattered across them are thousands of barns, but they're falling into disrepair. A reminder of a time when farming was carried out by families working small areas of land. Well, now some of the UK's leading architects are hoping to place freestanding holiday homes inside the barns without doing anything to their walls. Speaking to Martin Wainwright is one of the architects, Matt Somerville.
What we're doing is temporary, it's 100% reversible, and by that I mean that it has no direct or long-term impacts on the fabric of the barn, either in its construction or in its external appearance.
Oh, interesting. So you're inserting it, but in a way that doesn't damage it or fix it?
That's right. And the only place really where the pod touches the barn is on the floor, where we've laid the timber strip foundations over the existing flags, and then there's a gap effectively between the walls of the barn and the walls of the pod.
How interesting. So is it a bit like they do it with railway arches, don't they, sometimes in cities where they install something inside the railway arch but they're not allowed to actually touch the arch?
Yeah, it's probably similar. I think in that case as well, it's to do with dealing with the water that's coming in and shedding that to the sides. In this case, we've got something which is actually quite well sealed. We wondered initially whether the construction of the roof would allow some water to be blown through if it's windy and rainy, but it seems pretty weathertight. But the gap between the pods and the barn itself is useful for ventilating the space between as well and keeping it all relatively dry.
Great. Oh, well, can we go inside? I know it's a building site, but see once again.
Okay.
We're in the barn now, and it's much bigger inside than it looks from the outside. It's kind of TARDIS-like, and it's interesting that the pod takes up less than half.
Yes, and the pod, because we're working in a very small space, we wanted to make the most of the space we've got, and also to maximise the use of the shippen, which is the part of the barn that we're leaving open. It's got this original timber structure for the cattle stores within it.
What's the thinking behind? I mean, is a holiday a place to stay on holiday? Is that
yes?
Or that's one thinking, or are there several thinkings?
Well, across the range of barns, there are probably a different range of possibilities depending on how much space you've got and how good the access is. This particular barn is one of the smaller ones, and it's in a more remote position, so it's probably a barn, a type of barn that would be used more seasonably during the summer and probably during the winter and the autumn and the spring a bit as well. So that's why parts of the barn, at least on the lower level, are in effect, they're semi-external. They're inside the barn, but they're not completely enclosed inside the pods. So,
and somebody using it, I mean, I can see there's electric light switches going in. Would people be able to cook here? Would they be able to shower here?
Yes, and just to explain the layout briefly then, we've got, with the entrance vestibule here, there's a set of doors which fold back off that. Those two doors on the left-hand side there fold back to reveal a small cooking area.
All right.
And the door on the right-hand side is for some of the equipment or somewhere to throw your rucksack and scrape your boots off before you come in properly.
Yes. It really has got everything. Because when you first see it, you think, where is everything?
Yes, and the reason you think that as well is because there are no boiler flues poking out. Or there's nothing to indicate that it's a serviced space.
No.
And we really wanted to avoid any domestic detailing, such as the flues or anything that would suggest a permanently inhabited building. Mm. And we came up with our engineers, Ernest Griffiths, with the idea of the trailer pods, which is effectively a very standard agricultural trailer, which will be filled with all the kit that's needed to make the building habitable.
Martin Wainwright reporting. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.